we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Starting out with local and Seattle School District.
What about it?
Well,
something going on?
Some
where have you been?
This week.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mariel Goodloe Johnson, the first two words of her name being go, of course, is no longer school superintendent. That, on an interim basis, is going to Susan Enfield. The school board this week voting 8-1 to fire without cause Mariel Goodloe Johnson. If they had fired her with cause, it would have been a fairly high, substantial contract bar to meet. And so they decided to bite the bullet, as it were, and pay the entire salary for the next year as a severance package for both Goodloe Johnson.
Yeah, her base salary is $264,000 a year. They're just going to give that to her.
Yeah, also Don Kennedy, who's their chief academic officer, who came from Goodloe Johnson 4 years ago from South Carolina. So it's very interesting that they moved so quickly to fire Goodloe Johnson. And there's a reason for that, which doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the scandal. It has to do with management of the scandal, in that this coming November, the Families in Education levy is going to go on the ballot. And so it's a very sensitive political time for the school district. And the last thing they needed at this particular time was a massive undermining of public confidence in the school district, which, as we know, has been shaky for a number of years. So they acted very quickly to fire Goodloe Johnson and Kennedy. But the bigger question is it going to change the culture at all?
Yeah, I'm not optimistic. It's interesting, too, you know, some of the stuff that's been coming out about all of this scandal surrounding the small business contracting program. There were a couple of articles in the Seattle Times this week. One sort of looked into how Silas Potter got the job. He had no qualifications at all. It was a friend of his, Fred Stevens, who was the executive director of facilities, who urged him to apply and then later hired him against the advice of the search committee looking for someone to head that contracting program. It's pretty clear that Stevens hired him because he was a buddy of his, and that is very indicative of how the management of the school district works, that it's a old boys system, it's very buddy-buddy, and qualifications don't matter.
Yeah, and this is something that's gone on for a number of years, as we talked about last week within the school district, where there's been a real culture at the staff level in particular of us against them, us against the district, lack of transparency and a lack of accountability both to upper management and to the and to the school board. Although in this case, both the upper management and the school board didn't particularly want to know. There had been criticisms from the public of Goodloe Johnson's performance for the last 2 or 3 years. Parents and teachers, in particular, raising a lot of opposition to Goodloe Johnson and her top-down management style. And they seem to have been vindicated by this. There was a comment by Michael DeBell, who's one of the school board members who voted for Goodloe Johnson's firing, that it was necessary to, quote, change a management culture that bred an atmosphere of fear and intimidation. That is not a healthy atmosphere to have, obviously, but it's one that's been true for the last several school superintendents and leaderships, and it's permeated the school district. It hasn't just started with the upper management, but it's been part of the entire culture of that building, and that necessarily is not necessarily going to change. It'll be very interesting to see whether the school board, moving forward, what they look for in a new superintendent, and if they've acknowledged that this is a problem, the type of culture that exists at the school district, what they're going to do about it, and whether they're going to do it in a way that seems to the public to be accountable when the public has to decide whether to approve a very large levy this coming November.
All right. Moving on, developments this week in relation to medical marijuana.
Yeah, the state medical marijuana dispensary bill passed the state Senate on Wednesday, but not intact. An amendment put in place by Democratic Senator Tim Sheldon requiring nonprofit status for dispensaries. The problem with that is one that we've seen in California with the similar legislation there, where there was a requirement of nonprofit status, which requires a much different and much more strict accounting practice practices, and we've seen the state go after the dispensaries for criminal charges on the basis of their not following all of the nonprofit accounting practices. So it creates a large opening for harassment of these medical marijuana dispensary businesses by law enforcement agencies who don't particularly want to honor the spirit of the bill. In fact, California is going back this year and trying to pass a bill to fix that by allowing for-profit dispensaries because it's been so problematic there. So sponsors and the Democratic leadership of this bill as it goes to the House for consideration over the next couple of weeks are meeting this week to determine whether or not to continue to back the bill or whether to kill it and wait until next year. So we're going to have to see next week what they decide to do.
All right. Well, then that moves us on to national, and got a new budget has come out this week.
Well, no, a new budget has not come out this week. Congress decided they had a deadline of yesterday, Friday, March 4th, to avoid a government shutdown by either passing a new budget or passing a continuing resolution that would continue to fund the government for a period of time while a new budget is hammered out by the Republican House and the Democratic Senate. And in fact, they only passed it for 14 days, so we have a new deadline for government shutdown of Friday, March 18th. That 14-day resolution was signed off by House Republicans at the cost of about $2 billion in budget cuts agreed to by Senate Democrats. And Republicans have signaled that they're willing to do this all year long. They're willing to go a week or two at a time with cuts here and cuts there until they get all the cuts they want piecemeal, or they can do it all at one fell swoop. But they're not going, it seems like it's pretty much up to Democrats now at what point they're going to say, we can't afford any more cuts, we're not going to agree with the cuts that are being suggested by the Republicans, and therefore we're going to allow the government to be shut down. And if that happens, or when that happens, whether the public is going to blame the Democrats or the Republicans for that shutdown. So it's very much a game of chicken at this point in terms of the fact that for 2011 the federal government still doesn't have a budget.
Okay. Moving on, New York Times coverage this week of fracking. What is fracking?
Fracking is the process that has been very common in oil shells and shales, in the West for the last several years, and increasingly in places like Pennsylvania and West Virginia, of extracting oil from shales by the process of injecting water into deep, I don't know the technical terms for it.
Into deep shafts.
Into deep shafts, mm-hmm. and essentially flushing out the oil. The problem with this is that the wastewater created by it has some problems. And a very good investigative story by the Times last Sunday spelling out what those problems are, and the fact that the EPA and industry and oil and gas industry has known about these problems for many years, in particular the presence of a lot of carcinogens in the wastewater and the process of extremely high radioactivity in their wastewater, up to 1,000 times the allowable limits of radioactivity in that wastewater. The EPA under the Bush administration knew about this in 2005, 2006, and not only didn't require that it be regulated, but did not even require that industry monitor the output of wastewater for radioactivity as it gets into deep water groundwater and eventually into a lot of municipal drinking supplies. And that practice has continued under the Obama administration, so that as the practice of fracking has spread over the past several years, we've gotten contamination of water in a lot of different parts of the country and a lot of different cities, including very large ones in places like Pennsylvania, pose extreme dangers to public health. Again, this is something where, because as the price of oil continues to climb, as oil resources get more difficult and more difficult to extract, we're going to see more and more of this unless it becomes more stringently regulated. And right now, the momentum, particularly among Republicans, is to loosen regulations on hydrofracking. And not only that, but of course, we've seen with House Republicans talking about the congressional budget wanting to defund enforcement regulation activities of the EPA entirely. So very, very problematic what this might do to public health.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to developments in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I want to talk briefly actually about developments in Ohio.
Okay.
The Ohio Senate this week passed a bill to weaken public workers' unions. That bill is not the same as the bill in Wisconsin. It doesn't do away with collective bargaining, but it does do away with a lot of other very important rights for public workers that put the actually the things that make collective bargaining effective. It gives local officials the final say in breaking any labor impasse, which in the past, the old law would allow for a neutral third party to come in and break any labor impasse. But when you give that power instead to the local government to break the impasse with their workers, that means you've pretty much taken a lot of the power out of the union. It also bans the right to strike for all public sector employees, not just emergency personnel like police and fire and medical staff. It basically, when you take away the right to strike, what is the point of having a union? You can't collectively bargain unless you have some recourse if the employer isn't going to even sit down and talk.
And a very interesting aspect of this, that unlike Wisconsin, the anti-union provisions of this do apply to police and fire as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, from the Governor Kasich, who has famously called police idiots because one of them gave him a ticket for not yielding to an emergency vehicle.
Yeah, and unlike in Wisconsin, where the Democrats can pack up and leave and therefore deprive the Wisconsin legislature of having a quorum and passing a bill. In Ohio, the Republicans control the legislature, and so there seems to be nothing standing in the way of this bill passing the House and then being signed by the governor.
Yeah, although that's not entirely true, because the math would indicate that. However, when it passed the House this week, six Republicans actually voted against it. So
mm-hmm.
there is some hope in the Senate, which we'll consider it next week in Ohio, that Republicans may vote against it as well. There was a lot of additional baggage to the Ohio bill. In fact, one of the more amusing is that Ohio, which has already defined marriage as being between a man and woman, has a provision defining marriage as being between a man and a woman in this so-called budget adjustment bill. And so you can tell that it's very much an ideological bill on behalf of the Republicans. The other piece, of course, is that what national coverage there has been of the Ohio bill, which has been much less than Wisconsin because there haven't been the large protests that accompanying it, really hasn't dwelled on why Ohio has the budget crisis that it has. Part of it, of course, is the economy and the fact that all states are suffering. But another major part of it is that the same Republicans who are now trying to do away with public sector unions in Ohio passed they eradicated the corporate income tax a few years ago, and so revenue for the state of Ohio has taken a huge hit as a result.
Well, in addition to that, too, a lot of state governments are suffering not because they're paying too much to their public employees, not because they've had massive wage increases or benefits increases for public employees, but because during the boom times, they passed laws that allowed them to take money in those pension plans that were supposed to fund important government services and invest them in risky derivatives and hedge funds and so forth. And so when the financial crisis came, they lost a lot of money. It wasn't just people's 401ks that suffered. It wasn't just retirees' pensions that suffered. It was state pensions. It was state trust funds. It was state government budgets that also are suffering that lost money during the financial crisis. And a large part of that was because they passed laws liberalizing where they could invest public funds. And those are some of the laws that I've always opposed, as we've discussed our election coverage in prior years whenever, you know, and the state of Washington's passed those kinds of laws as well, and the state legislature too. And, you know, I've always discussed with voters, always vote no on these because these are risky and you don't want to take these kinds of risks with public money. But that's what happened, and now the public employees, it appears, are the ones who are paying for it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, a lot going on this week. Last weekend on Saturday, there were hundreds of rallies across the country, including several thousand in Olympia in support of the Wisconsin workers. On Sunday, 125,000 in Madison, a city which has seen its protests over the years, by far the largest protest ever in that state. And protesters occupying the Capitol building after a 4 o'clock deadline set by by the governor and his allies for clearing the building. People stayed there overnight, and they stayed there with the assistance of police, who said that they wouldn't enforce that particular edict.
Remember, the police union is a public employees union.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And even though they were conspicuously exempted by Governor Walker because, the police and law
He's
enforcement
not stupid.
Union. Well, no, they supported him during
mm-hmm.
his campaign.
Yeah.
It was the unions that supported him that, mm-hmm. that were exempted for some
oh,
odd
of
reason.
Course.
on Friday, yesterday, Walker issued a 15-day notice of state union layoffs if the impasse continues. Both Wisconsin and national polls, of course, showing solid public support for the public employees unions, 60-some percent in both cases, up to 70%, depending on how the question is worded. But what you're seeing here, aside from the fact that solidly Republican states like Indiana have already passed some of this type of legislation or edict in the past. The reason you're seeing it now in swing states like Wisconsin and Ohio is as a referendum to see whether Republicans can get independent voters and people who are, you know, usually not particularly affiliated with a political party to sign off on this agenda, to be hostile toward public employees unions on the logic that, well, if we're having a hard time and not being able to make ends meet, why should people working on the taxpayer dime have it any easier? And what they're finding is that argument is not selling.
Yeah, it's not selling. And it's interesting. I was looking at the New York Times CBS poll this week about whether or not people support public workers' rights to bargain collectively. And as Jobs said, the poll respondents came down in favor of that by 60% to 33%. What was really interesting among the statistics is I saw that 61% of respondents, including over half of the Republicans who responded to the poll, said that public sector pay is either about right or too low. And among the respondents, about a quarter of them had a public employee in their household, which is a reminder to us that we live in a developed nation where public services are key, are very important to sustaining our quality of life. And the fact that there are so many people who are public employees, even in a random poll like the CBS New York Times poll, is a reminder to us that when you start laying off public employees, that's going to have a major impact, not just on the services that you rely on, but also on the economy itself and on real people that you know.
Yeah, and on additional industries that require those services as well.
Yes.
There's
mm-hmm.
going to be a ripple effect if those layoffs happen, and you're going to see layoffs in private industry as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they always like to tout the trickle-down effect of every person who works, let's say, at the UW or at Boeing and all that.
Well, the UW is a public institution.
Yeah.
That's a public sector employee for you. You know, we don't tend to realize how many of the people we deal with in our daily lives are people who are paid through our tax money. Well, your tax money is working for you. You just often don't realize it.
All right. Let's move on. Developments this week relating to with Bradley Manning.
Yeah. Private First Class Bradley Manning is undergoing torture at the Marine Brig in Quantico, Virginia. Manning, again, for folks who don't remember, is the person who leaked the diplomatic cables and other government documents to WikiLeaks.
Allegedly,
yes. And this week, one of his friends told reporters that Manning has been confined to his cell for 23 hours a day with minimal or no human contact, and he's had only 1 hour per day of exercise in an empty room. So essentially, they're keeping him in isolation. And then this week, a couple of days ago, his lawyer said the current punishment for Manning is that he's being stripped of his clothing at night when he goes to bed, and then in the morning he's awakened and forced to stand at attention before he's given his clothes back. This is inhuman and humiliating treatment, and in many countries of the world it's considered torture to isolate a prisoner like this and to treat them this way. However, the U.S. military spokesman, a spokesman for the Pentagon, Pentagon Press Secretary Jeffrey Miller, excused the treatment by saying that it was due to, quote, the seriousness of the charges he's facing, the potential length of sentence, the national security implications. And then he went on to say, well, because we think he might try to commit suicide. However, Manning is not on suicide watch. He's not officially.
And all of those reasons are really compelling as to why a person should be kept naked.
Yeah, none of those are an adequate excuse for putting a person through that kind of torture.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, let's move on to rising food prices.
Yeah, this week there was a report in the New York Times that food prices are now higher than their 2008 peak when food prices spiked during the end of the boom years there. Food prices have now pushed about 44 million people into extreme poverty worldwide since June. That's according to World Bank statistics. Meanwhile,
and they've had a lot to do with the uprisings in the Middle East also.
Well, they have, but a big part of the reason food prices are so high is because of global climate change. And we've seen droughts and a lot of extreme weather incidents this year and in the past year that have made a lot of crops fail all over the world in places where we're used to seeing a big production of wheat and corn and soybeans, yeah, et cetera.
In particular, the extreme hot weather last summer in Russia, mm-hmm, and the grain crop failure there has had a huge effect.
And droughts in China and Australia. I mean, yeah, it's just worldwide.
And South Africa, South America.
Yeah, it's just worldwide. Meanwhile, because of rising food prices, it means there's been an extreme rise in the price of cropland and farmland. Farmland is now considered, quote, a favored asset class. That means that investors can now be suckered into paying a premium price for farmland because they're a little bit wary of paying premium prices for other assets like, say, residential real estate or commercial real estate where there have been a boom and a bust cycle. There hasn't been a boom and a bust cycle in farmland for at least a generation, so now that's where investors are parking their money. The main problem with that is that investors who buy cropland often don't work it. They don't plant the land. And when you buy cropland and let it sit, that's really bad for world food supplies. So we're looking at it. Well, of course, it also drives up the price of food, and that will also drive up the price of farmland. So for investors to buy farmland and sit on it, that's a win-win for them. It's a lose-lose for the rest of the world.
And to be clear, that's not just happening in the U.S. That's happening all sorts
of
places.
That's happening all over the world. In fact, there are protests in governments, particularly in Africa, where African governments have colluded with investors to sell farmland not to local farmers who would work it, but to sell it to big investors from the West who want to just buy and hold and not work that land.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Libya.
Yeah, we're rapidly degenerating into what looks like it might be a civil war in Libya, where the eastern part of the country is controlled by anti-Qaddafi forces and the western part of the country controlled by Qaddafi and allied mercenary forces and tribes. It really is degenerating. We've seen additional battles in the past couple of days where the Libyan government, such as it is attacking, and we're seeing this despite or because of really not a lot being done to interfere in this dynamic by the rest of the world so far. You've had sanctions being announced by Europe and by the United States, diplomatically, the Qaddafi government is quite isolated at this point. But in terms of its ability to actually carry out massacres of rebelling citizens, they've really been unimpeded in their ability to do that. The rebels at this point have public opinion on their side, but they have very little military training. They have very few weapons, and they're not very well disciplined because they have no military experience in a lot of cases. So it really is setting up as a nasty situation and one that the West is really not doing very much about.
Now, Qaddafi might be isolated from the West, but there are always governments, particularly in Africa, that are willing to take money to sell arms to him and to send troops to help him out. And that's clearly what's happening. He's been relying a lot on mercenaries from other African governments to supplement the few military troops that have stayed loyal to his government. Now, it's been extremely frustrating to me. I know Obama does not want to be George Bush. He doesn't want to stand up and say, let's charge in there and bomb the crap out of him. I understand that. But the reverse, he's done the complete reverse, which is stand back and do almost nothing until just the last couple of days when we finally imposed sanctions. you know, I think there's got to be a middle ground there where you step forward and say, okay, we are not going to be the world's policeman. Okay. But we can certainly get together with other governments and figure out what to do about this. Of course, a bigger perspective, you can look at the bigger perspective here. Libya is a tiny worry if you're Barack Obama and you've got troops in two wars in two countries, plus you're engaged in bombing campaigns in Pakistan, you're supporting bombing campaigns in Yemen, you're supporting
Somalia.
Yeah, and Somalia and other repressive governments around the world in the war on terror. Libya probably looks kind of small, even though it's getting a lot of the press attention now.
Although, like Somalia, Libya, a very tribal government, society rather, is very much in danger at this point of becoming a failed state because a lot of those tribes in different parts of the country aren't going to allow owe their allegiance to Gaddafi and aren't going to allow their allegiance to the rebels as well. You're going to wind up with tribes and warlords taking control of much of the country.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on. China. Their five-year plan.
Yeah, China announced a five-year plan for economic goals this week. And in addition to the usual growing of the economy that we've come to expect from China, they announced strict five-year goals for energy conservation, far better than anything even being discussed, let alone implemented in the United States. But even the Chinese goals don't go far enough to meet what the UN considers necessary to prevent world temperatures from rising by more than 2 degrees Celsius over the coming years. So we've seen very strict goals being put in place by China, a recognition of the value of energy conservation, and China in particular has become just as dependent as the United States on energy imports as their economy has expanded over the past decade. So they're seeing it as a not just a climate change issue, but a national security issue, and why the United States can't see either of those problems has a lot to do with, who bankrolls Congress at this point.
All right. And finally, Iraq.
Yeah, some developments in Iraq this week and over the past 2 or 3 months. It's become clear now that we intervened in Iraq to replace one repressive dictator with another repressive dictator. Maliki has been consolidating his power. This week, Ayad Alawi, whose coalition, Iraqiya, won the election and who has not been able to take power because Maliki will not give up power in Iraq, has decided not to head up a Security Council that Maliki was supposed to set up because, lo and behold, Maliki has not set up the Security Council. He has not defined its powers. He has not given it any powers to do anything in his government. Ayad Alawi is essentially saying, I'm not going to participate because this is not a democratic government. It's not a coalition. It's a farce. And in addition, Maliki has not appointed a defense minister and he has not appointed an interior minister. He is reserving those powers for himself. So like many dictators in the past, including Saddam Hussein, he now plans to maintain control of the military and of the state police and of the presidency as well. And he's just, you know, heading down the same path as other guys we have supported in the Middle East in the past.
To be clear, the whole rationale behind reserving for yourself the ministries that control the state police and control the military is to develop personal loyalty to you as opposed to loyalty for the state, for those institutions.
Yeah, and Maliki already controls a certain number of militia members, and he runs secret prisons where people are being tortured in Iraq. And in January, a court ruling helped decide that parliament in Iraq would no longer be able to pass laws, would no longer be able to initiate and pass laws. The only laws they can pass are ones introduced to them by the president or his cabinet ministers.
And what's been really interesting about this is that there's been almost no media attention to it in the
United States. No attention
in
the U.S. at all. It's just incredible.
Well, they've got to cover the latest developments with Lindsay Lohan and...
Oh, Lindsay is so 2010.
Yeah. All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. Got a new batch of articles coming up this weekend. And you have ongoing blog and humor and commentary. It's kind of a cool website. Check it out. www.eatthestate.org.
All right. And email address for those that want to reach out and touch someone.
editorial@epistate.org, and we are always welcoming of submissions. And if you want to write something, particularly about local politics, give us a shout.